I'm happy now to welcome to the program Norman Stamper. He is retired Seattle Chief of Police. He's author of the book Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. And he's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
So you are a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, and we've had people about once a year or so, maybe a little less, we have somebody from LEAP on the air to talk about and update us on the war, the so-called war on drugs. You, as a policeman for decades, have seen things close up. What does the war on drugs look like from your perspective during your career as a police officer?
Well, at the top of my list of failings would be the fact that it's been a colossal failure. We have spent $1 trillion prosecuting the drug war since Richard Nixon famously proclaimed drugs public enemy number one and declared all-out war on them, or more accurately, his own people. And it's reasonable to ask, what do we have to show for it? Drugs are more readily available at lower prices and higher levels of potency than when he made that declaration. In addition, we have arrested literally tens of millions of Americans for nonviolent drug offenses. A wildly disproportionate number of them are young people, poor people, people of color. And so it's safe to assume that the drug war, and I saw plenty of firsthand evidence of this, has fractured families and created untold heartache for an awful lot of Americans. And, you know, our position in Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is focused on crime and, to a somewhat lesser degree, addiction, but disease as well, but also violence. And one thing we know for sure is that prohibition produces violence. There is, there are no two ways about that. It happened during alcohol prohibition. It has happened over the past 40 years. And more recently, we've seen escalating, spiraling rates of torture and murder and other forms of violence that is really attributable to the organizing principle of the drug war, which is prohibition.
What does that violence look like? In other words, what are the contexts in which this torture and murder and everything happens? I mean, we obviously know about petty crime and burglary that people engage in to pay for their drug habits. What else?
Well, they also sell drugs to finance their next fix, or they sell themselves. So there are a variety of spin-off crimes, property crimes to be sure, but also prostitution and drug dealing that takes place. But the kind of violence that we're particularly focused on these days is armed violence that is undertaken with the idea of expanding or protecting one's illicit markets. And when you're dealing with profits as obscene as those associated with illicit drug commerce, $500 billion a year industry globally, you're talking about people who are very ruthless in defending what they have and expanding what they, you know, what they're looking to create. And so we see mayors and police chiefs and other elected officials in Mexico being murdered. We see heads of local government, for example, living in the United States, even as they represent constituencies in another country. The pattern, the severity, the frequency of violent attacks, very often using United States manufactured firearms, is really unconscionable.
When you talk about it, it basically sounds like what in other countries we might call warlords.
That's exactly what it is. We have a variety of colorful terms for it, kingpins and drug lords, and for that matter, warlords. But that's exactly what it is, and the situation is worsening by the moment. It is certainly not getting better. I oftentimes hear people say, well, we busted a major drug kingpin in Guadalajara or Mexico, and so that's gonna put them out of business, at least temporarily. And nothing could be further from the truth. Because of those profits, what's happened when one of these drug lords is assassinated or incarcerated, is you have 30 or 40 people waiting in the wings to take his position. And so it's an absurdity to assume that, you know, these photo op moments in which after a major bust, we see police officials, federal, state, local, lined up behind a big table with money and drugs and drugs themselves on display. And it looks impressive, a whole room full of marijuana or cocaine or heroin. But in truth, that's a tiny, tiny tip of the iceberg.
You also write in your book about the corruption within police departments in relation to drugs. What does that look like?
Well, virtually every police scandal that has taken place over the last several decades, with a few exceptions, are traceable to drug trafficking. A police officer who reaches into, you know, a 19-year-old's pocket and pulls out half a baggie of marijuana, keeps it, uses it or sells it, is one such example of corrupt police behavior. Where it becomes truly scandalous is when it becomes organized, and we have seen that in the Rampart Division of the Los Angeles Police Department, probably some 10, 12, 14 years ago. We've seen it literally in every police department in this country. Of any note, I'm sure there are some small jurisdictions that have escaped that kind of scandalous behavior. But the temptation is great, and if you happen to be a character-challenged police officer, it can be seductive. So, you know, there is absolutely no excuse for it. Every time it does happen, people need to be prosecuted, and upon conviction, sent to jail or prison. But it's important to be able to understand why that happens, and it is because of the what I would call the systemic economic implications of drug prohibition.
It's obviously difficult to police the police, so I would imagine that a lot of cops are getting away with this kind of behavior all the time.
Well, they are, I hasten to put things in perspective. The vast majority of cops, you've heard this before, are honest, they're forthright, they conduct themselves professionally, but even a small minority of police officers engaged in that behavior create a huge trust problem with the community. We lose the confidence of the community every time one of these things happens. And as you point out, because of the nature of policing, the institution itself, it's pretty easy to shield that behavior from the public, from an inquiring media, for example.
We're talking to Norman Stamper about his book, Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. Talk about what the drug war looks like currently with respect to states such as New Mexico that have legalized medical marijuana.
Well, that puts your state in league with my former state. I was a San Diego cop for 28 years before I became Seattle's police chief, and the state of Washington and the state of Oregon, a total of 16 states plus the District of Columbia have moved to legalize medical marijuana in one form or another. Each state has its own model. Some are you know, strong and defensible models. Others are quite weak. There is a, I think it's safe to say, a lack of a really sound regulatory system in place for any of the states. However, what it does represent, as ragged as it may be, is I think a wonderful example of the people of those states, recognizing that they are ahead of the curve, that they are more informed and more enlightened than are some, if not many, of their elected officials. And many elected officials are timid. They know in their hearts, they know in their intellect that marijuana and it is a drug that is less dangerous by far than alcohol. It's less healthy by far. It's more healthy, I should say, than tobacco. And yet, it is classified by the federal government as a Schedule I drug, which puts it in league with heroin and PCP and crystal meth. And it's just, you know, one more example of the absurdity of U.S. drug laws and the drug war.
This absurdity is probably clear to the majority, perhaps the vast majority of American citizens. What keeps it in place?
Well, I think what keeps it in place is a combination of factors. I think we need to look at who opposes marijuana legalization, for example. Well, the prison industrial complex does. It's a massive political bureaucracy with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people relying on that industry for their income and or their profits. And that's particularly true as we have moved disastrously, in my opinion, toward privatization of prisons, which rely for their funding and their profits on per diems. How many inmates can we possibly round up to fill these cells? And, you know, marijuana is a pretty easy bust, and if there's a sufficient quantity of it, or if there's been a hand-to-hand transaction, there's a pretty good chance that somebody's not just going to get a slap on the wrist or a misdemeanor citation. They're going to go to jail and ultimately to prison as a result of that. So there's big money to be made by prisons. I would also have to implicate, you know, the law enforcement, drug enforcement industry from the federal level with the DEA and to a lesser degree the FBI. The state governments and local governments, we have people who rely for their revenue on perpetuation of existing drug policy. And many, many of these criminal justice practitioners know that what they're doing is not only helpful, it's hurtful. So, you know, I'm very proud for that reason and many others to be a part of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, because we are both current and former police officers and prosecutors and prison wardens and judges and DEA, FBI, Homeland Security agents who have come to the realization that that our drug policy is just a huge mistake.
$1 trillion, the figure that you gave, is it's a big pocket full of change. I wish so much that in all these conversations that we would have on a national level about the deficit and about cutting from the national budget, that that would come up on the chopping block.
Well, you think about it. I'll just speak as a citizen of the country and at least temporarily take my law enforcement hat off. I read the papers. I'm influenced by national and, for that matter, international policy. But as a citizen, looking at the argument over the debt ceiling, looking at the argument over entitlements, looking at the debate over the amount of money that the government is spending on a wide variety of social programs, I cannot help but be struck by what we would gain if we were to end this drug war, if we were to divert at least a significant portion of the revenue necessary to support, you know, the drug enforcement industry, and put that money into prevention and treatment and education programs, we would have a healthier and safer nation for it, dramatically so. And yet, it's not on the table. I think, as you point out, we look at all these expenditures. We look at the $1 trillion we have spent fighting this drug war. And we're not taking advantage of a source of revenue that could be tremendously beneficial to everyday Americans.
I think not only of the money that we could save just wasting people's lives by arresting them and putting them in prison and the amount of violence that is involved with the drug war, as you talked about at the beginning, but also just the productive lives that could be lived if this prohibition were to go away.
No question about it. I have had occasion, particularly since my retirement, to have what I would consider to be longer and higher quality conversations with a lot of people who take drugs, a good number of whom are addicted to drugs, and who don't want to be in that situation. But their communities have no methadone, much less needle exchange and other harm reduction policies or programs. Those cities that do have these programs have long, long waiting lists of people who want to kick an addiction but can't, simply because we don't care. I mean, that's, to me, the bottom line. If we cared and we cared enough, we would find the funds for it, and we would recognize that instead of victimizing them, we would usher them into programs that are actually shown to work. Now, having said that, we take the position at LEAP that all drugs should be legalized, which sounds on the surface very radical, and I suppose in some respects it is. It's a fundamental plea for a fundamental change in drug policy. The rationale for that is we have a choice. We can either let these drug lords, kingpins, or street traffickers decide what they're going to sell and to whom they're going to sell it, at what price. And these are people who do not care about 13, 14-year-old kids enjoying their products. In fact, they oftentimes will channel free product to them so that they can enlist them in as future customers. And so we have the choice of either letting very greedy, very evil, unscrupulous people regulate and indeed monopolize the commercial aspects of drug trafficking. Or we can let an admittedly imperfect government move in on the strength of legalization to create a regulatory model to impose very stiff penalties for furnishing to a kid, for example, or robbing a bank or abusing a spouse, under the influence of a particular drug or in the sales of that drug in order to, as I said earlier, finance the next fix. So we do have a choice. And more we're finding people coming around to the point of view that we could have 40 years ago made America's drug problem a public health problem. We could have, in fact, financed, a vast and effective public education program. We could have reserved our law enforcement muscle for those who do, in fact, furnish to children or in any other fashion engage in what today would be criminally irresponsible behavior apart from drug use or drug sales. But we've, as a rule, we're still kind of stuck at this point that drugs are bad and people who take them are bad, and what we need to do is muster the entire strength of the criminal justice system to deal with what really is a public health issue.
We're talking to Norm Stamper. He's the author of the book Breaking Rank. You talked a moment ago about the folks you have been in contact with who take drugs and who are addicted to drugs. I think it's also worth mentioning the much larger number which takes drugs and is not addicted to them.
Right. Anyone who thinks that alcohol is not a drug has been completely duped. It is a drug. Many people use that drug responsibly. They use it for social purposes. They use it at mealtime, and they do not abuse that drug. They don't furnish that drug to children. They don't, if they're responsible, get behind the wheel of a car and drive impaired while under the influence of that drug. In short, there are, in fact, many, many people in this country, the majority of people who use that drug, who use it responsibly. We know that its abuse is a horrible problem. It unlike marijuana, for example, it does kill people in the tens of thousands every year. I'm sure you're aware there has never been a reported overdose death involving marijuana. You drink a fifth of tequila or bourbon and smoke marijuana, you might, in fact, have some very serious repercussions. But somebody who has only smoked marijuana is at zero risk of overdosing.
On anything besides Doritos.
That's right. We do see people, you know, young people in college, tragically, who engage in binge drinking and suffer acute alcohol poisoning, and they die. And take tobacco, for example. Now, our position, certainly my personal position as well, is young people should not be taking any drugs, including alcohol and tobacco. And it's not just because of, some simplistic notions about just saying no to something that might be harmful to them. It's about explaining why and how it is harmful. Drugs like tobacco, alcohol, and currently illicit drugs affect brain development, which many researchers suggest. Theoretically, we can grow and increase our brain power from day to day and month to month and year to year and decade to decade. But in truth, the greatest growth is between, prenatal and perinatal period and 25 years of age. Now, if we set the drinking age at 21, if we set recreational use of marijuana at 21, and get smart about how we reach out to kids, and by being smart, I mean, among other things, not lying to them, telling them, for example, that marijuana is a gateway drug. If we're smart in how we talk with them, if we treat them with respect, I'm sure that we can convince a good number of young people to stay away from these drugs until they're old enough to handle them responsibly.
How did your thinking about all of this change during the course of your time as a police officer and a police chief?
I did, early in my career as a beat cop in San Diego, come to the conclusion that I could have been spending my time, when I was engaged in nonviolent drug offense arrests, I could have been spending my time doing what I call real police work, which is to say I could have been working to stop people from hurting other people. Domestic violence certainly comes to mind. That's been a passion of mine, the prevention of domestic of violence and child abuse for decades. I could have been doing that. I could have been patrolling my beat, looking for the and I worked nights mostly in my early career, trying to find the suspect or suspects who were taking away half my beat in burglaries and robberies during the daytime hours. I could have, in short, been working to stop people from hurting other people. Instead, I'm spending hours out of service processing, for example, a marijuana arrest, with a small baggie of leaves and seeds and stems, and impounding that, and impounding the person who was in possession of it, and writing at least two, if not three, reports. And all of that time has taken me off the streets and away from work that is really valuable to our society, to our communities, and vital, in fact, to our communities.
We're talking to retired Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper about his book, Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. Let's talk more about domestic violence. Your book, which, by the way, is a really wonderful and vividly written book about policing and has some pretty tough stories in them. It starts off with a letter to the former Tacoma police chief who shot his wife and then shot himself. And you write in that section of the book that a significant number of people who become cops experienced violence and abuse themselves growing up. Talk about that. What is that like? What are the consequences of that?
Two things can happen to children who witness spousal abuse, for example, mommy beating daddy, or much less commonly, mommy beating daddy. But in general, two things can happen, and this is apart from those situations where the children are also abused physically and or emotionally, or where they live in a milieu of violence. I would call it the violence vocabulary. You finish those P's are all slap you silly, the kinds of comments that suggest that the way to resolve differences or the way to parent, for God's sakes, is to threaten physical violence or to carry it out. But just in a family situation, for example, where a child witnesses it, he or she is at much greater risk to conclude as an adult or in a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship in one's teen years, that the way you resolve differences is with a fist or a gun or a knife. And so kids who witness domestic violence growing up are at much greater risk to carry it out. The alternative to that is that they become pathologically passive. They don't know how to handle conflict. They don't know how to say, for fear that that violence could be invoked, or simply being haunted by the memory of the fists flying and the other forms of violence in their own homes. I mean, kids learn violent behavior, and the breeding ground for violence in this society is the American family. So let's assume for the moment that a kid grows up in that kind of an environment and is now in a situation where he or she is needing to express important and relevant and totally understandable emotions. I'm jealous. I'm envious. I'm insecure. I'm this, that, or the other. And if they don't lash out physically, what they're likely to do is to internalize it. I don't mean to turn psychologist here, but I have spent a good deal of my life studying patterns and forms of violence. And one of the things that's just so heartbreaking is where you get a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a spouse who is feeling jealous and insecure, being completely incapable of expressing that emotion in a grown-up way. And, of course, this applies to an awful lot of people for whom violence was not the norm, because, generally speaking, we tend to ignore those kinds of issues in interpersonal relations and interpersonal competence and, in general communication skills that make us uncomfortable. I've got a number of friends who say, I hate conflict. I can't stand conflict. Well, what if you're feeling it? Is there a healthy channel? Is there a smart way that you can express it that will actually help defuse the situation and maybe create some understanding? And, of course, one of the things we try to do with police officers in an enlightened police organization is to teach them these diffusing skills and ways that they might be able to help broker some peace in a family that may be on the verge of physical violence.
But I mean, what happens when they themselves, as you say happens quite often, grew up in a situation where there is physical violence, where there is verbal abuse? Those people are more likely to perpetrate that on others, like it or not. Those are the statistics. And then you give them a gun and a badge.
Well, that's true. And in giving them the gun and the badge, what we have done essentially, because they are fundamentally unsupervised day by day, you know, moment by moment. The sergeant could be all the way across town. They don't have a partner. They are essentially on their own in many situations. And if they're not mindful, if they've not worked on their issues, the likelihood that they're going to do one of those two things that I mentioned earlier under color of authority is much, much greater. In other words, they will resort to violence in their everyday police practice that perhaps could have been prevented. My personal theory is that most of the excesses in police work are perpetrated by cops who are afraid. I'm shifting gears here on you for at least a moment, but if I'm afraid and fear is not a socially acceptable emotion for me to express in my culture, namely a police department, guess what? I'm going to act out on that fear, which means I'm going to compensate. I'm going to more likely than not act impulsively. I'm not going to be exercising self-restraint and self-control and maturity because the fear has overridden whatever instincts I may have along those lines. But I think what does complicate the picture is, in fact, when we give to a member of society a badge and a gun with whatever level of education and training, with that, whatever level of an intensity of scrutiny that we have applied in hiring them in the first place, we're basically saying, geez, we hope that you can handle your emotions now that you're in a situation. You know, it could be a barroom argument. It could be a domestic violence call. It could be anything. You're in a situation now that calls upon you to be mature. It calls upon you to exercise control, which is desperately needed in most of these situations, in an even-handed and fair and calm way that doesn't add to the problem. And I shudder to say I've seen countless examples over the years of police officers who have made matters much, much worse. I was such a police officer during my rookie year. Ashamed to admit it, but compelled to talk about it, as a cautionary tale to other human beings who don't learn how to handle their differences and their grievances and disagreements before they become cops.
We're talking to Norm Stamper. You have a chapter in the book on officers who abuse their power and the questions about disciplining them. How do they tend to be disciplined? Are they even caught a lot of the time? How should they be disciplined? I mean, it seems, again, as a person who's outside of that world but who reads the paper, like they don't get punished by the same standards as criminals who do the same crimes.
That's true. You know, I'll sort of work back from that question if you'll indulge me here for a moment. In cases of criminal behavior, police officers are far too often simply dismissed, if not kept, which is an incredible situation. But if they engage in criminal behavior, at a minimum, they need to be fired. But I always believe very strongly that if there's a strong prosecutable case behind some on-duty criminal misconduct, a prosecution sends a real strong message to the community, but more importantly, frankly, to the officers themselves. You do not get the benefit of a double standard here. Now, having said that, I think most police departments' disciplinary systems are dysfunctional in a profound way. We tend to treat frontline police officers in our paramilitary organizations as dependent or delinquent children. In other words, we do not, through our interpersonal conduct, but also our systems of discipline and performance evaluation and supervision, we do not treat them as mature and respected adults. And it's pretty basic. You know, if I get treated like a delinquent kid, there's a pretty good chance I may act like that. If I get treated with respect and with dignity, even as I'm held accountable for my behavior, the chances that I will become that mature, competent, and predictable and reliable police officer that we so desperately need, those chances are dramatically increased. So when we punish a police officer, for example, for an honest mistake, we've done exactly the wrong thing. People say, well, you know, you make a mistake, you get punished.
What's an example of an honest mistake in this context?
An honest mistake would be a non-negligent, non-reckless traffic accident. Let's assume for the moment that you've exercised reasonable caution, but you simply weren't alert or attentive enough and you backed into a light standard. To receive a suspension, to be punished punitively, I'm being redundant there, but to receive punitive disciplinary action, it is exactly the wrong thing to do in that situation. That calls, no doubt, for corrective disciplinary action. You know, hey, Norm, pay attention.
But, I mean, those are, if I may say, those aren't the things that people get excited about. People get excited about, for example, the kind of, you know, beating up the black kid. I mean, there's you have a chapter about the racism in policing or using excessive force, or, you know, you give some examples in your book of running checks on their ex-girlfriend or all kinds of just basic abuses of power because they can get away with it.
The difference between that behavior, which I certainly agree with you, is egregious behavior, is that is willful misconduct. What I'm drawing here by way of distinction is the difference between willful misconduct and honest mistakes. If we treat honest mistakes, for example, improper procedures, not handling evidence properly, and it was done honestly, but it was mistaken, it was not the right way to do it. If we handle that stuff, which often afflicts the newer officers punitively, we create this we, they, us, them situation within the ranks, and we find behavior beginning to escalate. It's usually true that a newer officer is dedicated to doing things right, doing things well, but makes a mistake, then gets punished for that, loses money, is suspended, so on and so forth. Watch out for that officer to become the kind of officer who does those really terrible things. I believe that willful misconduct, the default position should be termination. If it's not sufficiently egregious, not sufficiently severe to justify termination, then it does demand punitive action. And putting that employee on notice, if this happens again, you're going to be looking for work elsewhere. We don't want you in this department if that's the way you're going to behave. And it does require not just tough talk, but tough action to get rid of those police officers who cannot or will not conduct themselves in a professional way. And you're absolutely right. Racism, sexism, homophobia, misogyny in general, other kinds of isms, are alive and well in American policing. You know, I think we ought to be, it ought not to shock us that that's true, since, you know, those brands of bigotry are also not uncommon in the larger society. But when you, to use your expression, when you put a badge and a gun on a police officer and grant that officer life and death authority and peace and freedom, discretion, then you have every right and every obligation to hold them to a much higher standard.
Now, you spoke a moment ago about the militarization of the police, and there's a chapter in your book on that as well. what are the differences between the police and the military, and what happens when those boundaries get blurred?
Well, the fundamental difference between a soldier and a cop, for example, is that the soldier follows orders for a living. The police officer makes decisions for a living. Awesomely important decisions, delicate, demanding, sometimes dangerous decisions. And is doing so not as part of a squad or a company or a platoon with a sergeant or a lieutenant or a major directing his or her every move. It's an enormously different job. But the trappings of militarism, the titles, the uniforms, the oftentimes the disciplinary procedures and the like can be very, very similar. My bias, and it's a strong one, is that we need to treat police officers as professionals. Treating them as professionals helps to create a self-fulfilling prophecy. We know that they are decision makers. That is what they do for a living. And these decisions are not unimportant. So if we value them, if we recognize and reward good work, if we call from their ranks the ones that can't or won't do the job well, then we will have taken a giant step toward the kind of policing we need in this country and the kind of policing that, I don't mean to turn this into a speech, but the kind of policing that, that our communities deserve.
I mean, it's true that many people, myself included, are terrified of the police. I mean, the one scary incident that ever happened to me where I had to call the police, the way I was treated was scarier than the incident itself, and that's unfortunately common. I mean, how you've heard many of these stories before. What is to be done about that?
Well, I think I'd have to repeat some of the things that I've already said about how we treat our officers. If we're looking systemically, if we're looking long-term, if what we really want, and I believe it is what we really need, is institutional reform, a radical transformation of American law enforcement, we have got to begin with the structure, you know, the paramilitary structure, which produces the culture, which gives rise to the behavior. And every time we get some horrible event, and a horrible event for me is big and dramatic and noteworthy, if not notorious. And it's also these kind of everyday things where I called the cops and I felt like I was the suspect. I called the cops and the police officer ignored me. I called the cops and the police officer was rude to me or did not explain this or that or the other. In other words, I called the one person that I thought was appropriate to call because I needed help. And what I got was not help. In fact, quite the contrary. So all of that, I think, falls under the general heading of the police culture, which is a product of the structure. And so if we want to change the behavior, if we want to prevent the events of the type that you described, we have got to get serious about changing the culture. And there's a group of people inside policing who don't want to change it. And these are the unions, generally speaking. There are a handful of what I would consider to be good unions. And I wouldn't even necessarily characterize them as progressive. What I would say is that they're professional. And they don't want within their ranks these cops that give the institution a black eye. And they'll work with management, you know, to help create fair and responsible disciplinary systems and performance evaluation systems and promotional practices and the like. But I would say, and this is difficult for me to acknowledge, that most police unions are so wrapped up in hours, terms, wages, the hours, wages, and terms and conditions of employment that they forget that they're cops. They forget their professional orientation. Or if they remember it, they don't act on what it felt like, for example, to be full of the badge for the first time, and your job is to help people. It's to stop people from getting hurt. It's to help people who need help. And you do that in a professional way. You do it in a human way. You do it in a courteous and dignified way. You know, the best cops are the ones who have succeeded in spite of the system. So
right.
You know, my indictment, if you will, and it is a strong one, is of the system. And that does not mean that you ignore individual misconduct. You must not do that. But it does mean that you take a deep breath, draw back a little bit from this event, that event, and see if they're linked, see if there isn't a pattern of behavior there. Because if there is, it's the culture.
Now, it's so interesting to me when I read your book. Again, we're talking to Norm Stamper about his book, Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. I mean, you're in favor of drug decriminalization and government regulation. You're in favor of gun control and drug treatment programs and social programs that would prevent crime and abuse. My sense when you talk about the culture of policing is that it's overwhelmingly politically conservative and not in favor of those things, which doesn't really seem rational to me. I mean, it seems like cops should be in favor of things that make for a more peaceful society and make their jobs easier and more harmonious with the communities in which they're supposed officers of the peace.
That's exactly right, and I agree with your, you know, if you're perplexed, so am I on one level. But on another level, here's what I've thought about over the course of my 34 years in the business and the 10 years since I've left it. There are paradoxes in human behavior that are accentuated in policing. In police work, for example, we know that the best police work prevents a crime. And yet, any cop worth his or her salt will confess that when that robbery call comes out, the adrenaline, the cortisol, all these other chemicals in our body that make us excited, maybe a little scared, but leaning toward the challenge, create a situation where, okay, so we didn't prevent the robbery, we didn't prevent the domestic violence case, but now we can do something about it. And there is this tendency, particularly, I think, with armed violence, to get excited about it, to become enthused and under the influence of those chemicals that course through our bodies, and to feel the elation in catching somebody who has, in fact, hurt somebody. That side of the business, the enforcement, the detection, the apprehension side of the business, putting people in jail, is what fundamentally defines most police work today. Well, what about somebody who has, pardon me, for example, my sensibilities, which is we are peacemakers. Let's do everything in our power to make sure that those crimes don't take place. And I'm not suggesting that police officers go out of their way to avoid involvement in prevention efforts. Some certainly do. But when push comes to shove, they'd much rather catch somebody who's committed a crime than prevent somebody from committing that crime. And I would simply cast that as a paradox and say, not until we have sort of I would put it this way, until we've rearranged the way the molecules are organized, until we have restructured policing and shaped a new police culture, and this is not going to happen by Tuesday of next week, will we see that kind of shift that you and I would both love to see?